On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Strategies for Preventing and Managing Harmful Cyanobacteria Blooms. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document of the same name produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, academia, the private sector, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty any materials nor endorse any specific products. So before I turn this over to our expert speakers today, I'm going to set the stage with some general information. So why is it important to have a guidance document focused on cyanobacteria? Cyanobacteria are native species found in nearly every type of aquatic environment, lakes, rivers, wetlands, even damp soil. In lakes, ponds, and rivers, they can become very abundant, forming masses of cyanobacteria known as blooms. Under some conditions, they may also produce compounds harmful to people and animals called cyanotoxins. Every year, locations around the U.S. report blooms that have been linked to human illnesses and, in some cases, animal deaths. This causes impacts to recreation, drinking water, farming, and wildlife. Current science indicates that the future is bright for cyanobacteria. Environmental conditions around the world are increasingly expected to move towards those that cyanobacteria love. A warming climate means longer growing seasons and warmer lakes in areas that don't have them right now. Increasing precipitation means that more surface runoff reaches our waters and that runoff is expected to carry more of the nutrients cyanobacteria needs to grow. So more places to live and lots of food to grow. We need to be thinking about the steps we can and need to take to make it more difficult for cyanobacteria to grow. The ITRC guidance document built on the extensive experience of the ITRC HCB team members from 2018 to 2020. Team members represented federal, state, and local experience, natural resources, public health staff, scientists, and people living around lakes. Not everyone has experience responding to HCBs in the same way, and having these diverse perspectives was key to building the guidance document. The team discussed what worked, what didn't, and what aspects of cyanobacteria management are important to consider. The ITRC team purposely brought all aspects of cyanobacteria responses together into one document. The ITRC guidance document shares successful approaches used around the country and links you to resources that you can explore as you learn more about cyanobacteria management and responses. So with that, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert speakers today. They will cover five topics in cyanobacteria management and response. To kick us off today is Gina La Liberté with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for the introduction of cyanobacteria. All right, Gina, take it away.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for joining us today, everyone. So today I'll be reviewing the HCB introduction, which you can find in Section 3 of the HCB guidance document. I'll be giving a brief introduction to cyanobacteria biology and ecology. I'll review the terminology that we used in the guidance document, and I'll briefly go over the health concerns that are associated with HCBs and current regulations and guidance. So when we're talking about cyanobacteria, we're talking about blue-green algae. So cyanobacteria, I'm ahead of myself here. So I'm going to start out with some cyanobacteria basics. So cyanobacteria are naturally occurring and are widely distributed across both aquatic and terrestrial environments. In the guidance document, we focused on those in freshwater and estuary habitats. So cyanobacteria do have some beneficial ecological roles, such as serving as a food source for other organisms, providing oxygen via photosynthesis, and some are able to fix atmospheric nitrogen into a form that's usable by algae and plants, which uses specialized cells that you see indicated by the arrow. Cyanobacteria have some unique characteristics that help them to form persistent blooms, including forming resting stages or dormant stages, such as this enlarged cell that you see indicated by the second arrow. So cyanobacteria, with planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water column, can regulate their buoyancy using the gas vesicles that you see as the dark bodies in the cell indicated by the bottommost arrow in the photograph. So what do cyanobacteria look like, and how can you tell them apart from other green things in aquatic systems? We have a really great visual guide to the common harmful cyanobacteria in Appendix A of the guidance document, and a video on how to identify cyanobacteria blooms. The visual guide has field photographs of blooms and microscopic images, and it covers cyanobacteria by what form they grow in, such as in colonies or filaments, and by what habitat they grow in, such as planktonic in the water column versus benthic, attached to surfaces or on sediments on the bottom of aquatic habitats. The guide also includes examples of things other than cyanobacteria, such as plants, filamentous algae, and other kinds of algae, as there are many things that are often mistaken for cyanobacteria. So now I'm going to start out by reviewing some of the terminology that we used in the HCB guidance document. So when we talk about cyanobacteria, we're actually talking about blue-green algae. Cyanobacteria is the more scientific term, since cyanobacteria are actually true bacteria that photosynthesize. And the group that's considered to be algae encompasses many other things other than bacteria. So it's important to remember that not all harmful algae blooms, known by the acronym HABS, H-A-B-S, are harmful cyanobacterial blooms, for which we use the acronym HCBs, and which you may have seen elsewhere as cyanohabs. There are other algae that can form HABS or nuisance blooms in freshwater or marine habitats. The bottom photo here is Spirogyra, which is a filamentous green alga, and you can see that it superficially resembles the HCB in the photo at the upper right. So the terms that we use for cyanobacterial accumulations can vary based on the location and type of accumulation. They can also intergrade, or more than one type can be present. So blooms are visual accumulations of cyanobacteria in the water column. You can see them as discolored water, as you see in these two photographs. The guidance document focuses on planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water and which may be concentrated at the surface, throughout the water column, or at a depth. Planktonic cyanobacteria can form scums, which are accumulations on the surface of the water, typically during a period of calm weather, or floating cyanobacteria may also be concentrated by wind on the downwind shoreline, which you see in these two photographs. And finally, these aren't planktonic cyanobacteria in the photo, but there are benthic cyanobacteria that can grow as mats on sediments or on surfaces on the bottom of a water body. And these can float to the surface as nuisance accumulations, as you see in this photo. So ITRC has benthic HCB guidance, which is linked from the planktonic HCB guidance document. So check that out. So those were the different types of HCB accumulations. So what are the factors that promote cyanobacteria growth to HCBs? The specific environmental conditions that promote HCBs can vary by water body and the cyanobacterial community growing in it. But in general, cyanobacteria grow and accumulate into HCBs with favorable environmental conditions that include an increase in nutrients. So both phosphorus and nitrogen are needed to fertilize HCB growth to high concentrations of cells. Increases in water temperature plays a role, as cyanobacteria tend to be adapted to grow better at warmer water temperatures than other kinds of algae. And finally, hydrological stability, whether that's stratification in a lake, slow flow in river systems, or reduced turbulence, provides conditions that allows planktonic cyanobacteria to concentrate near the water surface as blooms or scums. We do need to keep in mind that climate change can enhance the environmental factors that promote HCB growth. Warmer temperatures and longer growing seasons creates optimal growing conditions and promotes the persistence of HCBs from 1 year to the next. Periods of drought enhances hydrological stability via stratification or by slowing river flow. And finally, a very important factor is that we're seeing intensifying rain events in most of the United States, and heavy rain events can bring nutrients into aquatic systems via runoff. So what is it that actually makes cyanobacterial blooms harmful? We consider HCBs to be harmful because some can produce cyanotoxins and other irritants that can cause serious health effects in people and animals. These compounds include hepatotoxins that affect the liver, neurotoxins that affect the nervous system, and dermatoxins that affect skin and mucous membranes. Cyanobacteria can also make other types of compounds that can cause general irritation and allergic type reactions. HCBs can also have adverse environmental effects. When large blooms decompose, that can cause low dissolved oxygen. HCBs can also increase shading that impacts aquatic plant growth. So I'm going to talk a bit now about cyanotoxin production and release. Toxin production can really vary over time and space. It's important to remember that not all cyanobacteria can produce toxins, and those that can don't make them all the time. So something we do need to take into account when it comes to monitoring cyanobacteria is that multiple toxin types can be produced by a single species. And in general, toxins are held within intact cyanobacterial cells. So toxins are considered to be intracellular. There is an exception for the toxin called cylindrospermopsin, which can be released into the surrounding water from actively growing cells. And then for the other intracellular toxins, those are not released to the water or become extracellular until the cell dies and lyses and the cell wall is broken open. So this can happen gradually, such as when a bloom naturally decays, or it can happen suddenly, such as when a chemical treatment is applied to an HCB or if cells are ingested. So how are humans and animals exposed to cyanobacterial blooms and cyanotoxins? Potential exposure can occur near or in a water body containing an HCB. This can happen if you accidentally swallow affected water that contains cyanobacteria and their toxins. You can also be exposed if you breathe in aerosols from water spray or mist, such as by water skiing over a lake containing an HCB, or through direct water contact with skin. Another exposure route is by ingestion of contaminated drinking water or food. And animals can be especially at risk from HCBs and their toxins because they tend to have a higher exposure while drinking and swimming in affected waters. Animals don't avoid contact with water that people would normally not want to touch. Animals can be exposed from ingesting the cyanobacteria that they groom from their fur or feathers, or by intentionally eating scum or mat material that's washed up on shore. Children can also have a higher risk because of their smaller body weight, so it doesn't take ingesting as much cyanotoxin to make them ill as for an adult. Children also tend to spend more time in the water and have more hand-to-mouth behavior that can increase their exposure. So, given the risks, what regulations and guidance do we have for HCBs and cyanotoxins? Currently, we do not have federal standards for cyanobacteria or cyanotoxins. However, we do have guidance from the US EPA for the toxins microcystin and cylindrospermopsin in both recreational and drinking water. Recently, in March 2021, the World Health Organization released recreational guidance for four toxins: microcystin LR, anatoxin A, cylindrospermopsin, and saxitoxin. Additionally, many states have developed their own regulatory or guidance values for HCBs and cyanotoxins. However, these tend to be focused on planktonic HCBs. Guidelines for benthic cyanobacteria are lacking. Now, please see the ITRC benthic HCB guidance for more background on this. And please stay tuned for the next modules in this training. We'll cover guidance and selection tools to help you develop a management plan for HCBs. Next, we're going to cover monitoring for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. Other modules address communication and response plans, in lake management and control methods, and nutrient reduction as a strategy to reduce HCB occurrence. And now we're going to hear from Ben Holcomb, who will be covering monitoring.
All right, thanks for the introduction, Gina. In this section of our HCB training, we'll talk about how to monitor. I'll talk about analytical methods used to evaluate cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins, and about field collection methods, basically how you'll fill that bottle that'll be delivered to the lab. I'll demonstrate the use of interactive selection tool that the team's developed to help you explore which analytical methods may be useful for your water body and your goals. Finally, I'll talk about the elements of a cyanobacteria monitoring program. When I finish this section of today's training, you should have a basic understanding of how to design and conduct a monitoring program to meet your needs. So let's start with how we monitor for cyanobacteria. Monitoring provides the data you need to describe the conditions. For HCBs, that means counts and measures of cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They will help you describe what kind of cyanotoxin or cyanobacteria is present, how much is there, when, and where it's found. You may also choose to include water quality parameters that describe conditions that support HCB growth or how HCBs are affected by management strategies you've started in the lake or in the watershed. I'll talk a little bit more about those later in the training. Most important objective when monitoring for HCBs is to support your HCB response plan. A response plan tells you what to do when a bloom is reported and outlines what level of cyanobacteria or cyanotoxin will require you to act, such as closing a beach or posting signs along a recreational path. You'll learn about response plans in the next segment of our training today, and you can read more about it in section 5 of our guidance document. As I mentioned earlier, HCB monitoring can support your HCB management activities. Actions to control cyanobacteria can be focused in the lake itself, such as the application of phosphorus binding chemicals, as you see in the photo here, or be undertaken in the watershed to reduce the sources of nutrients that encourage the growth of cyanobacteria. If you decide to include monitoring for management success in your HCB program, you'll want to begin monitoring before those actions start so you can characterize the cyanobacteria community before the conditions change. After your management begins, then you can continue to monitor using the same method so you can track how the cyano community responds to your management. More on this monitoring approach will be discussed in the management and control section later in today's training. So monitoring is all about your needs. It will identify the methods you'll use in the field, specifically making sure you get the data you need for the action or alert levels called out in your response plan. Because you know how often you'll sample, the cost of the analyses, and the number of people you'll need to do the work, you can set a budget for the program. This is important to keep you from spending all your funding in June when you know blooms will still occur in August, September, et cetera. A plan also helps maintain consistency across time. When a bloom occurs, things get hectic quickly, and you don't have time to think about these things. So lots of people are calling you, they're asking for information, they have, you know, concerns about health, et cetera. So having a plan means you don't have to think about what's appropriate to collect or where to go. You've already have those decisions in writing. So having a plan also means you collect the same data in the same way each season, and you can better compare current data to past experiences or track trends over time. All right, so the terms monitoring and sampling are often used interchangeably. However, they do have different meanings. In our guidance, sampling refers to the collection of a single point of data in response to a bloom. As you see, the person in the photo filling a bottle from a visible scum. Monitoring is the collection of routine data to detect impending blooms or track changes over time. Monitoring represents a series of samples, including some that may be collected in response to a bloom situation, but monitoring is mainly visiting the same locations at set intervals, regardless of whether a bloom is present. All right, let's turn now to the actual methods used to measure cyanobacteria. Our guidance document discusses six methods. These are commonly used to decide whether cyanobacteria are present and how much might be there. You can see the methods here on the slide. They range from simple methods that require minimal training and not many tools to those that are far more complex and that require specific training and often very complex equipment. Each method is evaluated using the same set of criteria. You can see the criteria on the screen here. I'm not going to read those all off. But we discuss, for example, the kind of a result the method provides, say cells per mil or micrograms per liter of chlorophyll A. In the document, there's a summary of these criteria for each method, so you can easily compare one method to another. So it's also important that you understand the criteria we use. We've provided a definition in our guidance, and you should take a look at how we interpret it and compare it to how you might interpret it. So consider turnaround time, for example. We define turnaround time as the time needed to prepare the sample, run the analyses, and get the raw data. If you're sending a team into the field to collect a sample, that time is not included in our definition. To fully estimate how much time it'll take before you have to have data to share, you need to add the field time to the turnaround time. If your sample location is located far from your lab, there are a few methods that will get data to you in less than a day. There's one important thing to remember about cyanobacteria methods. They don't provide any information about cyanobacterial toxins. It's not possible to use any of these methods to tell what kind of cyanotoxins are present. You must use a method designed specifically to test for cyanotoxins. So let's take a look at those methods to test for the cyanotoxins. Our guidance covers six methods commonly used for evaluating cyanotoxins. Like the cyanobacteria methods, they range from those that are simple and require minimal tools to those that require specialized training and equipment. Similar to the cyanobacteria methods, we use a single set of criteria to evaluate each method and summarize them in a table associated with each method so you can easily compare them. There are some key things to remember about cyanotoxin analytical methods. No single method can provide information about all possible toxins. So you're going to want to consider which toxin you want to analyze for, whether that method is slightly different than another cyanotoxin method, and plan accordingly. Also, guidance values may not be available for all cyanotoxins. Guidance values help you understand the meaning of your toxin result. Let's say 4.5 micrograms per liter microcystin is just a number without the guidance telling you how to interpret and use it. There are federal guidance values for several cyanotoxins, as Gina mentioned, and some states also have developed their own. As you build your monitoring plan, it's important to know what guidance values are applicable to your water body. Another thing to remember is that there might be interference from compounds, environmental or otherwise, when analyzing your samples. It's important to understand your method and the possible interferences so you can use the proper bottles, preservation, or otherwise minimize their effect on your analyses. Your samples may require specific preparation or extraction. There's especially important for plant and animal tissue samples. They require different prep than your routine water samples. So these preparation methods are continually changing and improving, so it's important to review available methods and use the best sample preparation for your goals. So you're going to want to review these on an annual basis. Finally, it's important to remember that cyanotoxin results tell you only about conditions at the time you fill your bottle. They can't tell you about what happened 2 days ago or predict what will happen 2 days or 2 hours in the future. They're just a snapshot And you need to use that context when you're describing the results. So now let's talk about sample collection methods, how you'll fill the bottle that will be analyzed in the lab. We created a flow chart to help you decide which field methods to use. So this is a part of it here. The full flow chart is in our guidance document in the web portal. So you select the water body type, such as still water or flowing water, possible locations to sample, and then you can see which methods may be appropriate. The location of the HCB is important in deciding which field sampling approach you use. So we've developed a graphic to remind you of possible locations for HCBs you'll find in our guidance document. If you're looking for floating HCBs, you'll want to use the planktonic method. If the HCB is located on the bottom, attached plants, or washed up on the shoreline, you'll want to use the benthic approaches. If you're interested in cyanotoxins that may be in the water, we call those extracellular, you'll use another set of methods. The HCB1 guidance document is focused primarily on planktonic or the floating HCBs, but we've added a new document, HCB2, with information about benthic HCBs. Training focused on HCB2 occurred a few months ago, and that training is available on EPA's CLUIN website. All right, so let's discuss how to build a monitoring plan for your water body. A monitoring plan is the story of what you're going to do. It tells everyone why you're sampling, when, where, and how you'll sample, as well as who's going to do it. A monitoring plan for Largeville Reservoir here that I've got up on the slide, we'd want to consider a monitoring plan here that would meet the needs of all the stakeholders. And we've got some clues here about what those stakeholders are. Federal, state, county facilities. There's a couple of drinking water facilities, as well as recreational uses like boaters, swimming, and fishing for the public. So as you consider developing a monitoring plan for a location like Largeville Reservoir, you'll want to consider the sustainability of that action in the long term. Your budget needs to include sufficient resources to cover staff and analytical costs, the training that they may need, any quality control requirements. As I mentioned before, for a large water body that is subject to frequent blooms, monitoring costs can be high, particularly if you try to do everything. So it's important to find that sustainable balance between getting all the information you want and the basic information that you really need. Partnerships with stakeholders around the water body can help with those costs. If you consider Largeville Reservoir as an example, there are several stakeholders who could assist with that monitoring, like a beach or the boat launch manager can report on daily cyanobacteria conditions. The drinking water facilities might be able to cover some of the costs for the toxin analyses, and just keep your options open. Don't forget to consider whether there are additional environmental conditions you'd like to track alongside your cyanobacteria monitoring. Adding something as basic as water clarity measurements, as shown here on the slide, to your monitoring adds only a little bit of time and the cost of a Secchi disc. It's a simple measure that may allow you to evaluate both cyanobacteria presence and their effectiveness of your BMP. All right, now let's demonstrate the use of our monitoring tool to evaluate which analytical methods might be appropriate for your lake. So let's stay on this kind of example of Largeville Reservoir as how we might build our monitoring program. So there have been no previous bloom reports on this water body, and there's no monitoring program in place currently. However, a dog illness has been reported from the county boat ramp. The state investigated the area and confirmed the presence of both cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They recommend that a monitoring program be developed for the reservoir. All right, so since this is the first bloom reported from Largeville Reservoir, they don't have a response plan to follow. However, there's some basic information that they would like in their monitoring program to provide. They'd like to be able to learn quickly about cyanobacteria conditions so that they can communicate rapidly with the public. They'd like to monitor in such a way to get a heads up when conditions may indicate a bloom is forming. And finally, they want to make sure that their monitoring provides information for the drinking water facilities, the recreational activities on the reservoir, and to keep pets safe. All right, so this slide is a screenshot of our monitoring tool as it appears on our webpage. It includes all the criteria that we use to evaluate each of these methods. So three of these criteria allow you to whittle down the list of 12 methods to those that are of more interest. So for example, if we want to find those that are the fastest, we would uncheck the box indicating a lab is required. And we'd also uncheck the box for a turnaround time of 1 to 3 days. So this will get us the quickest methods for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. So when we make that selection, this list of cyanobacteria methods appears. Note that I couldn't include the cyanotoxin methods on this slide just because of the space. But the list of the methods that are on the left side of the table, these are all hyperlinked directly to the guidance document, so you can easily read about them. And the first six columns are color-coded. The green indicates that the method is appropriate for the criteria. Red indicates that it isn't. Let's look at the first three criteria under the cyanobacteria. The first one, the P/A, just simply refers to the ability of the method to tell you whether cyanobacteria are present or absent. So all four of these methods have green circles, meaning they can be used to tell if cyanobacteria are present. The next criteria, ID, refers to the ability of the method to identify the cyanobacteria to the genus level, say whether it's Microcystis or Dolichosperma. All the circles here are red, which indicates that these methods can't do that. And the third criteria, DEN, refers to the ability of the method to evaluate the density of the cyanobacteria. And you can see that two of the methods can be used for this while the other two can't. And all three of the cyanotoxin criteria have red circles, reinforcing what I said earlier, that cyanobacteria methods can't tell you whether cyanotoxins are present. So you can also use the monitoring tool to quickly compare all the methods to one another. So for example, if you're looking for methods that are lower in cost, you'd read about those methods indicated by a single or a double dollar sign. For those that can be done by just about anyone, you'd look at those identified as having a level of training at novice or intermediate level, as you see there on the column on the right. Again, all the methods are hyperlinked directly to the text for that method in the document, so you can quickly and easily compare them to one another. All right, so let's wrap up the discussion on monitoring by reviewing the key things I'd like you to remember when you're building a monitoring plan. So first, be sure to identify your goals and choose those analytical methods that get you the data you need. If your guidance says beaches will be closed when cell counts exceed 100,000 cells per mil, using a visual assessment won't get you the information you need to close the beach. Use our monitoring selection tool to evaluate methods and find those that can meet your needs. Build your monitoring plan to tell the full story, the who, what, when, where, and why, and make a plan to meet your needs. Your needs are outlined in your HCB response plan and may also be incorporated into the HCB management plan. Finally, consider how to make your plan sustainable in the long run so you can compare current and past conditions. All right, so now I'll turn it over to Devin so we can get to our first questions.
All right, thank you, Ben. So with that, we're going to jump right into our first question and answer period. If you guys have anything you would like the trainers to address, please feel free to put that in the Q&A pod. I will pause here for a moment and give you guys a minute to enter any questions. If we don't have any, we can move on to our next module. We do have another Q&A portion at the end of the training. All right, getting a few questions in here. So I will just start reading them off for our trainers. Do you know of any monitoring methods to detect viruses that can attack cyanobacteria? This can result in bloom death, causing toxins to spike.
This is Gina. I can answer that. We didn't really address monitoring for some of these other aspects related to blooms, including viruses. I believe there is some it's an active area of research in Lake Erie because viruses were implicated in the Toledo water crisis in 2014. There was a large bloom and viruses were lysing the cells, which released microcystin toxin, making it very difficult for the water utility to efficiently remove microcystin from the source water in the course of producing finished drinking water. So if you delve into the scientific literature from Lake Erie, there may be some information there about how they monitor for viruses, but that's not really something that we were able to address in our guidance.
All right. Thank you, Gina. So it looks like that's the only question we have right now. So I will just to conserve time and be efficient, we will move to the next portion of our training. And then if, like I said before, we do have another Q&A portion at the end. So please put any questions you have between now and then in the Q&A pod, and we will make sure they get answered. So with that, I will hand it off to Christine.
Oh, got ahead of myself. Thanks so much, Devin. So in this module, we're going to talk about how you can use risk communication and risk communication planning to improve your response to harmful cyanobacterial blooms. We'll cover the basics of risk communication, your response during a bloom, and long-term planning to prepare for blooms in the future. So you may be wondering what risk communication is and how it's different from other forms of communication. Risk communication offers a science-based approach for communicating effectively in situations that are high stress, unfamiliar, or controversial. It provides people with the information they want or need to make informed decisions about threats to their health and safety. And like all effective forms of communication, it customizes messages to meet the needs of different audiences. Effective risk communication helps you build a good relationship with your audience, a relationship that is based on shared goals, values, and problem solving. The following risk communication best practices can help you cultivate that relationship during a bloom event. Start by learning what your audience knows about the risk and listening to their concerns. Convey information in a way that your audience can understand. Combine understanding and empathy into your explanations of risk, and build trust and credibility through accurate information and frequent updates. Consistent, concise messaging is critical to effective risk communication. Message mapping helps you create brief yet comprehensive messages. The message mapping process helps you identify three short key messages that answer questions about who, what, when, why, where, and how. Remember, when people are under stress, they have difficulty understanding and retaining information. So take that into account when developing your messages. Your key messages should include information about health risks, health advisories, and water-related activities that may threaten human or animal health. Once you've developed your key messages, coordinate and collaborate with other credible sources to help reinforce these messages. And finally, meet the needs of the media. They can help you get your messages out, but only if you organize your information and provide it to them in a timely manner. Preparation is the key to successful risk communication. That's why it's important to have a plan in place before you need it. A plan helps you identify issues as well as your potential audiences and their needs, create clear and concise messaging, and anticipate problems so you can address them beforehand. It's also important to evaluate your communication efforts after the fact and see what worked and didn't work and make adjustments to your plan. If you're interested in more information about how to develop a risk communication plan, consult the ITRC Risk Communication Toolkit on the ITRC website. Harmful cyanobacterial blooms require two types of planning: an immediate communication and monitoring response plan to be used during the bloom, and a long-term response plan that's built and updated during the off-season. This training and the accompanying HCB guidance document will help you prepare these two types of plans. It's critical to establish, immediate HCB response planning consists of five key elements: reporting, notification, and coordination, bloom confirmation, drinking water source identification and response, issuance of health advisories, and reporting on HCB-related illnesses. Let's take a few minutes to walk through each of these key elements. It's critical to establish effective reporting and notification methods so you can respond quickly and efficiently when a bloom occurs. You want to develop a reporting mechanism that can be used by partner agencies, stakeholders, and members of the public, and make sure that all bloom reports go to a centralized location. You also want to set up a process for alerting other organizations, such as the health department, state parks, or lake managers, to let them know that you've received a report of a bloom. Once you've notified your partners, coordinate a bloom response that may include sampling or site visits. Finally, you'll want to notify the public when you confirm the presence of an HCB. Tell the public what you know and that your data are preliminary. Outline the steps you will be taking to ascertain the severity of the bloom and let them know when you will provide them with an update. After you receive a bloom report, you can use visual observations to help you determine if the suspected bloom is an HCB. You can also use remote sensing to provide you with additional info on bloom size or characteristics before visiting the site. It's best if you identify your field sampling objectives before you go, so you have the necessary sampling equipment. Once there, you can decide where in the water body to sample to give you the clearest picture of water conditions. Before you collect samples, as Ben was mentioning, consider the type of lab analysis you have in place and the sampling data required to issue a health advisory. Ben mentioned in the previous training segment, the monitoring section of the HCB guidance document and the interactive monitoring tool can help you decide which sampling methods make sense for you. Communication and outreach are critical to an effective bloom response. You'll want to let the public and the media know what you know and don't know about the bloom and where they can go for additional information and updates during an HCB event. These information sources may include a dedicated website that offers regular updates on bloom conditions, call-in lines with pre-recorded messages, and social media channels. If possible, include information on how to report a potential HCB-related illness to your local poison control center or health agency. HCBs can impact drinking water sources, so you'll want to make sure you coordinate with the affected public water system if a bloom can or does affect its drinking water source. Under the best-case scenario, the system already has a cyanotoxin management plan in place. But if not, the HCB guidance document on the ITRC website contains resources to help water systems prepare one. If the public water system doesn't have a plan, you can assist them by providing sampling data or collecting samples near plant intakes and outflows. The treatment plant may want to use alternative water sources until the bloom subsides. Public notification is crucial if a drinking water source is affected, particularly if the system is not equipped to remove cyanotoxins. A drinking water HCB fact sheet can help members of the public understand the situation and take appropriate actions to protect their health. Consistent signage helps the public understand the health risks in an area with an HCB. People want to know what kind of recreational activities are permitted or prohibited and how they can protect themselves, their family, and their pets from exposure. Color coding and icons can help you deliver your message quickly and succinctly. Plain language instructions increase public understanding and compliance with health recommendations. You may want to include more than one language on your signs to ensure your message reaches diverse populations. Experience has shown that many people are concerned about the health of their dogs and may not be aware of the dangers posed by an HCB. So include information that helps dog owners keep their pets safe. You may also want to consider installing permanent signs at water bodies that experience frequent blooms. Health advisories protect public health and safety in the event of an HCB. It's best if advisory thresholds are established before a bloom occurs. Many jurisdictions develop health-based advisory thresholds for cell count concentrations in cyanotoxins and identify the agency with the authority to issue health advisories. You may want to create a flowchart with advisory thresholds, roles and responsibilities for issuing an advisory, and requirements for lifting an advisory. Consider how you'll post advisories, and remember, the more places you post this information, the better. Signs at the bloom location, a press release, a dedicated website with frequent updates, and social media platforms are all good ways to get the word out. It's important to provide members of the public with information about the health risks posed by exposure to HCBs and how they can protect themselves, their families, and their pets. Centralized reporting and data collection are key to effective incident reporting, so you'll want to identify an agency or organization the public can contact to report symptoms and the location of their exposure. Some states partner with their local poison control center or health agency to gather health data. When people report a human or animal illness related to an HCB exposure, be sure to notify the public so others can avoid areas that pose a health risk. So let's talk for a minute about how you could use risk communication to address an HCB. In the scenario you saw that Ben provided first, a dog becomes seriously ill after playing in the water at Largeville Reservoir. Your agency suspects a harmful cyanobacteria bloom. Largeville and Smallbrook residents are unfamiliar with HCBs and are worried about their health and safety. Fortunately, your agency has dealt with HCBs in other parts of the state, so you're prepared. Let's walk through the five steps of an immediate bloom response to see how your agency might handle this particular issue. Step one. Reporting, notification, and coordination. Your agency receives a call from a vet on your 24-hour HCB report line after treating a dog for suspected cyanotoxin poisoning. The vet tells you that the dog was playing around the boat ramp at Largeville Reservoir before falling ill. The duty officer on the report line notifies agency staff and partner agencies about the incident. State park staff volunteer to sample the area near the boat ramp that afternoon. You notify the public about the possible HCB using your social media channels and promise updates as soon as you know more. Step 2, bloom confirmation. State park staff collect samples and deliver them to the lab before it closes for the day. Your agency has the samples analyzed for toxins since the dog fell ill so suddenly. The lab reports there are high levels of cyanotoxins in the samples. You immediately use all available media channels to let the public know what you know about the bloom and how people can protect themselves and their pets until more is known. This information helps people stay calm. You direct residents and the media to your website and social media accounts for info and updates on the situation and provide a toll-free number for the local poison control center. Further investigation shows the bloom originated at Smallberg Lake. Your agency briefs city officials, the state park, and county officials on the situation. You also schedule a town hall for Largeville and Smallville residents to answer questions. Step 3, drinking water response. Drinking water staff at your agency contact the Largeville drinking water plant about the bloom. The utility doesn't have a cyanotoxin response plan, so your staff offer to collect samples at the plant intake and outflow. The plant closes the water intake from Largeville Reservoir and uses an alternative source until more is known about the extent of the bloom. The drinking water plant issues a press release to let people know their drinking water is safe, along with the steps it's taking to protect public health. Step 4, health advisories. The local health department confirms that cyanotoxin levels exceed health advisory thresholds and closes the area of the Largeville Reservoir near the boat ramp. The rest of the reservoir and Smallberg Lake are put under a health advisory. The health department and your agency provide bilingual signs for the lake and reservoir and issue a press release to notify residents about the advisory. You also post information to your social media accounts. Step 5, illness reporting. Several families recreating near the boat ramp experienced vomiting and diarrhea a few days after the dog fell ill. They call the local poison control center to report their symptoms. The center staff collects their information, tell them to contact their physician, and put the information in the center's HCB database. So you may remember we talked a little earlier about key messages and message mapping. Here's an example of 3 key messages you might use to inform the public and the media about the bloom. The messages are short and to the point and answer who, what, when, where, why, and how. The words highlighted in red show who is providing the information, what residents want and need to know, and how they can stay safe. Your agency, who identified what a harmful cyanobacterial bloom in Smallberg Lake and Largeville Reservoir, where. The health department, who issued what health advisories for what toxins. What people can do, do not swim in the water and obey posted notices. Long-term bloom planning generally takes place during the off-season. This is the time to review lessons learned from the previous HCB season to prepare for the next. Notice that many of the features of long-term planning were critical to the successful response in the HCB scenario we just discussed. Long-term response planning includes routine and response sampling and monitoring plans, drinking water emergency response planning, communication and outreach, collaboration with partners, data management optimization, evaluation of reporting and communication of HCB-related illnesses, and an evaluation of the current response plan. So here's some key takeaways. Risk communication is an important component of an effective bloom response. As we discussed at the beginning of this module, risk communication provides members of the public with the information they want and need to make informed decisions about the risk from HCBs. Planning is an integral part of the bloom response process. That's why it's important to develop immediate and long-term plans to address HCBs before, during, and after a bloom event. And finally, clear messaging and timely communication about HCBs build the trust and credibility needed for your agency to protect public health during a bloom event. And now I'll turn the time over to Liz Smith from the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. Liz, take it away.
Thank you, Christine. Participants, welcome to Section 6 of the guidance document. You've already learned about identification, response, and communication, and in a little bit, you'll learn about watershed level approaches. But this section focuses on managing and controlling blooms in lakes and other water bodies. Check my controls. I'm not sure that my, there we go. Excuse me. Okay. Help, we have a bloom. Naturally, we hope that lake managers and stakeholders will explore this resource before they're confronted with a crisis. However, we recognize that people might arrive needing help. So this section of the document is designed with that in mind. Our goal is to provide an organized and cohesive framework to learn about different strategies and evaluate their suitability for use in a given situation. The web portal allows users to browse online and download documents directly from Section 6 and the associated strategy fact sheets in Appendix C. It also allows users to explore options interactively using an online strategy selection tool. Let's take a tour. First, let's look at the guidance document. Section 6 is fairly short, but it's important. It provides an overview of considerations that apply broadly to all in-lake control and treatment strategies. It includes a review of some factors that you'll want to account for before selecting an approach. We'll talk about those in a bit. You'll also find a summary table that lists the 24 strategies that were researched in depth. And you'll notice that the entries in the table are all hot linked. Those links in the table lead directly to Appendix C, which contains over 70 pages of detailed content. There are downloadable fact sheets for each of the 24 strategies, and also a cost comparison table and a short summary of about half a dozen additional strategies that are not covered in depth individually. The modular structure makes it easy for resource managers to focus only on strategies suitable for their situation. How did the team decide which strategies to include in fact sheets? First, we focused on surface water, excluding treatment methods designed primarily for drinking water or wastewater utilities. Those engineered water systems have a different set of considerations and associated robust body of supporting research and literature. We also limit our research to freshwater and estuary water bodies rather than marine systems. Most importantly, though, the strategies we included are those that have been evaluated in peer-reviewed mainstream scientific literature or government agency white papers. There are a number of methods, both old and new, that at this time have primarily anecdotal support or support only from vendors and not yet from independent evaluators. Those methods were not included. A quick note, although the fact sheets and online selection tool were originally focused on planktonic blooms, both have been updated to include benthic blooms from HCB2. Let's look at a fact sheet. Each one is designed to stand alone, but they have a common structure to facilitate comparison. This one is for hypolimnetic oxygenation and aeration. The header shows the type of strategy, as well as the strength of support for its use in both planktonic and benthic blooms. A strategy is considered an intervention if it's meant to be used on active blooms, whereas a prevention is used to reduce the likelihood or intensity of future blooms. Supporting data is considered substantial if evidence of its effectiveness is clear and robust. For a strategy that's not been studied as thoroughly or that has had some mixed results, it might be limited. Meanwhile, a relatively new method that has mostly laboratory rather than field support would be scored as emerging. Note that because there's been less research on strategies for benthic blooms, some may be characterized as unknown or with no supporting data for benthics. So the fact sheet starts with a general technical description, which may be illustrated with photos or diagrams. Then there's a checklist to summarize conditions where treatment has been demonstrated most effective and the type of bloom for which it's best suited. Later in the fact sheet, you'll see a summary of advantages and limitations, which is followed by a brief cost analysis, at least one case study, and notes about regulatory and policy considerations. Finally, the literature references for each fact sheet are included to make further research easy for the user. If there were one perfect, affordable method to control every bloom, every lake manager would already be using it. Instead, we know that HCBs, like all other problems that are both complex and persistent, attract many attempts at treatment and solution. To use a medical analogy, the water body is not well, and HCBs are the manifestation of sickness. We have a landscape of treatment options, old and new, short-term, long-term, more or less invasive, more or less costly, but different treatments are better suited for different cases. The more you know about the situation, the better your odds of making a good choice. So our resource does not give prescriptions, but instead serves as a compendium aimed at giving users a systematic overview of strategies that have support in current literature. It's not intended to promote one strategy over another, but to support informed decision-making, to help you consider the context, understand constraints, weigh pros and cons, and set realistic expectations for outcomes. So is choosing a strategy as easy as choosing a fact sheet that looks good? Of course not. We want to make an informed decision by sorting through options in a logical way. We can group strategies according to a variety of factors. What are those top level considerations again? First, each strategy can be characterized as a prevention, an intervention, or both. Next, what type of water body is affected? Is it a pond, typically with a depth of 10 feet or less, a lake or reservoir, that's a larger water body with a residence time of over a year, or a river? And finally, are you concerned primarily with planktonic or benthic blooms? As you'll see in a moment, these are the factors that serve as primary filtering criteria in our interactive management criteria selection tool on the web portal. But let's not go there quite yet. If we're serious about identifying a strategy for a real-world situation, we do want to collect some additional information. First, we want to know all we can about the water body. Characteristics like surface area and depth, residence time, mixing regime, and natural turbidity and chemistry will affect our choices. Also, if a lake is highly enriched or eutrophic, it's important to know whether that input is from internal loading or ongoing from the watershed. Are there use-related factors that might limit our choices? For example, is this a drinking water storage reservoir? Are there swim beaches? Is management limited by presence of protected species, important game species, or invasive species? And finally, if your water body has seasonal or other special influences to consider, for example, ice cover or regulated water level changes, take note of those too. And of course, we want to know as much as possible about the bloom. Is it a new problem, or is there a history of frequent recurrence? When does it occur? Is there an element of seasonal predictability? And what about location and scale? Does it tend to start in one area or accumulate in one area? And how bad is it? Is it mild or intense? Do we know what species are most abundant and whether cyanotoxins have been detected? And last but not least, there are the practical and human considerations. How important is bloom control relative to other management and use priorities? Are the littoral zones important for fish spawning? Is it more important to have swimmable beaches in July or safe drinking water year-round? Are there other management actions in place that could present conflicting goals? And what are the logistic constraints? The immediate budget, the ongoing budget, and available infrastructure and staffing. It's important to consider whether there are regulations that constrain options too. For example, placing structures on the lake bed or applying algicides. This varies from state to state, and sometimes even at a local or water body level. It's also important to consider stakeholder perspectives and overall risk tolerance of managers and the community, including your downstream neighbors. This is a major consideration for both rivers and reservoirs. Now let's go to the management criteria selection tool. We have our information assembled and we're ready to explore options. As we know, the web portal offers Section 6 and Appendix C, as well as this management criteria selection tool. Here's a screenshot. This allows the user to explore options interactively. So we're going to use it to explore a scenario on Smallberg Lake. What do we know about the situation? Smallberg Lake is a shallow, well-mixed 50-acre lake with an unregulated outflow. It has nutrient loading from a lot of places, septic systems, resident waterfowl, probably from row crops in the watershed. There's also a golf course and a private community. It's loosely managed by the county. There's a county park and a scout camp on one side and the private shoreline on the south. Residents know that it gets green during most dry summers, but there's been no real concern in the past. However, a visiting colleague from Largeville Reservoir recognized it as an HCB, tested the bloom, and found toxins, which put an immediate stop to recreational use. So the county is starting from scratch. They've never thought about HCB management before. They're interested in both intervention and prevention for this planktonic bloom. We note that this is a small recreational lake, well-mixed, long residence time. What else do we know? It's eutrophic, probably with some regular external nutrient loading. But the managers are open-minded about options. They're willing to explore methods with limited or emerging support, as well as substantial research evidence. Rather than reading over 70 pages of fact sheets, they're going to start with the interactive tool on the web portal to explore those 24 strategies and apply the factors we just discussed. But because they're using such broad selection criteria for a common water body type, only one option is actually eliminated as a candidate. However, using the additional sorting factors in the output table, they're able to eliminate five more strategies, two that are not recommended for turbid lakes, which are acidification and UV exposure, and three that are not relevant for shallow lakes, artificial mixing, hypolimnetic oxygenation, and hypolimnetic withdrawal. So this diagram shows the 18 candidates that are left. It includes a range of strategies that have emerging, limited, and substantial supporting data. In theory, they might all be possibilities for use in a small, relatively shallow system like Smallberg Lake. Five of them are categorized as prevention, four as intervention only, and nine may be considered as both prevention and intervention. So the next step is to investigate them further. Stakeholders want the lake's problem to be fixed ASAP. So the county convenes a community meeting with speakers from Largeville University Environmental Science Department, the County Extension Office, and lake managers from nearby Largeville Reservoir. The speakers remind everyone that there's no universal fix, so they need to discuss options. Now let's walk through the options with the stakeholder community. First, they have eliminated monitored natural attenuation. They want something done right now before the 4th of July. Next, two physical methods are eliminated: dredging for being too invasive and expensive, and hydraulic flushing because it's not compatible with the dam outflow structure. Dye shading is also rejected because it would change the lake's appearance. And after more research and discussion, several other methods are rejected for being too untested, too unavailable, or too expensive. Those include food web and microbial biomanipulation, nanoparticles, ozonation, organic biocides, and skimming and harvesting. And finally, the university expert cautions that phosphorus binding compounds and flocculation may not be the best solutions since the lake continues to have nutrient input from the watershed. So those are set aside too. What do we have left? The universe of options has been constrained through careful and systematic consideration. Fortunately, there are still some viable options to work with. Some are well tested, others have limited support, but stakeholders are willing to consider them all. They check with the state's Department of Environmental Quality to see whether there are any regulatory constraints, and they learn that all remaining strategies are allowable, although some regulations may apply and permits may be necessary. So the county decides to apply peroxide algicide lakewide. If this doesn't work, they'll have another meeting to consider a one-time use of copper algicide. Next summer, the emphasis will be on prevention. The county staff, along with volunteer help from the scouts, will install barley straw in the north part of the lake next spring. And with some help from the golf course, the Homeowners Association is buying an ultrasound device for their corner of the lake. They will also research floating wetlands. So, to review, the stakeholder and management group has decided to adopt a variety of approaches. The county does not want to treat the lake year after year, but they will hire a lake management company to knock down this year's bloom with algicide. First with peroxide, with chelated copper, maybe as a backup. During and after the algicide application, no recreational use will be permitted, and the cyanotoxins will be monitored until they fall below levels of concern. Over the coming months, the county will work to acquire barley straw to install in the North Shoreline next spring, and meanwhile, the Homeowners Association and Golf Course will buy an ultrasound device and research floating wetlands. As you may already have guessed, the county government has been wise to recognize this as an opportunity to strengthen communication and monitoring. They're convening a stakeholder group that includes lake and watershed interests, and they've agreed to pay for lakewide toxin testing, working with Largeville University scientists to track results and update the community through both traditional and social media. Before implementing a strategy, let's go back to section 6 of the document to make sure we haven't forgotten anything. Yep, the county has done these things. As part of choosing the strategy, they've researched permit requirements and checked in with stakeholders. They've considered the possible side effects and deemed them acceptable given the uses of the lake. They've gotten estimates from several different lake management companies and reviewed the short and long-term budget impacts as well as the logistics. Finally, they're working with the community to communicate their goals and plans. Perhaps most importantly, the county now knows that in order to evaluate different strategies, it's important to monitor both before and after implementation in both the treated and control areas if possible. For Smallberg Lake, they're trying one strategy in the North Cove and one in the South. They plan to monitor conditions in both locations, as well as at the dam where no treatment is being applied. With help from experts and students at Largeville University, they'll collect samples for cyanotoxins and cell counts on a weekly basis before and after the treatments, along with dissolved oxygen and nutrients and water clarity. The county has asked the State Wildlife Agency and the State Regulatory Agency to review their plans. Both agencies agree that it's important to measure dissolved oxygen and toxins when applying any algicide. They like the monitoring plan, and they note that the lake management contractor that was selected is well established and familiar with the permit process. As we've seen with this Smallberg Lake example, adaptive management will increase your odds of understanding and success. HCBs are complex phenomena, and no two are exactly the same. So set realistic expectations. Make methodical, careful decisions based on as much data as possible, but remain flexible and learn from every attempt, whether successful or not. This is how adaptive management works. That first toxic bloom can induce panic, so it may require conscious effort to take a step back and look at the big picture to consider the fiscal, practical, and ecological consequences of any approach. Use the event as an opportunity to recruit allies and communicate with stakeholders. If intervention strategies are planned, determine in advance what cue will trigger an intervention. And of course, throughout implementation of any strategy, include a monitoring plan that will close the loop and allow you to assess the effectiveness of your management and control efforts. One final note, the fact sheets presented in Appendix C do not include everything that's on the market today, and certainly not everything that will be on the market tomorrow. Again, complex, persistent problems continue to inspire many attempts to solve them, and new options are emerging constantly. So when you encounter a new option, evaluate it systematically by asking the same questions. Are peer-reviewed independent field studies available? Does the evidence match the claims? Does it fit your particular water body and management goals? What are the upfront and recurring costs? And how often does the treatment need to apply to be applied? What are the possible short and long-term impacts to the water body? And is it reversible or will it leave a lasting impact? Are there possible side effects or residuals? These are all important questions. And what are our key takeaways then? As we've seen, the options can seem overwhelming. They can be overwhelming, but you can improve your odds of success by learning as much as possible about your water body and the bloom. And then set goals realistically, realistic relative to water body uses and to fiscal and other constraints. Consider whether proposed strategy treats the symptom or addresses underlying causes. include a well-designed monitoring plan with your treatment so that you can evaluate the efficacy. And you can use the management and control section of the guidance document to help you work through the steps and considerations. And most importantly, do understand that in-lake management strategies are just one part of the bigger picture that includes understanding and monitoring, response and communication, and watershed management. And with that mention, I'd like to welcome back Ben Holcomb from Utah Department of Environmental Quality.
Okay, thank you so much, Liz. All right, let's jump into the final module, strategies for use and nutrient management. This module covers section 7 of the document. So to provide some initial context, I plan to discuss these four categories of nutrient management with you today, review the factors influencing HCBs, steps for success, the ITRC HCB web portal and the tools we've developed, and to help you use them, we're going to go through a scenario application. All right, so as you've learned through the introduction training module, there are a number of known variables that contribute to HCBs, yet many unknowns that influence the extent, magnitude, and duration of the blooms. Nutrients, light availability, and temperature, and the timing of the three as they relate to seasonal growth, strongly influence planktonic HCB formation. However, of these variables, nutrients are the contributor that we can only hope to control on a local level that may lead to preventing blooms. The most prominent source of nutrients will vary by location, making it important for water managers to understand the land use and the surrounding area. There's significant difficulty removing nutrients from our waterways. They're pervasive and found naturally throughout our watersheds. They're intertwined with our everyday life. They are persistent and can accumulate within a watershed. Finally, they're a necessity for growth and ecological function. So optimal amounts vary with time and location. In this training and our guidance, we place more emphasis on the carrot approaches to reduce nutrients. However, there are regulatory aspects with controlling nutrients within many states that can be employed, which can assist with the stick approach when needed. These nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, are typically the elements that limit growth in terrestrial and particularly aquatic ecosystems where planktonic HCBs occur. So as more are added to the system, more growth occurs. Let's briefly cover how human activities can increase the levels of these nutrients in our water bodies. So first, let's talk about phosphorus. In contrast to its elemental form, which is used every day in our LED light bulbs, it's found as phosphate outside the laboratory. As an element and molecule, it's sticky. So aside from point source effluent discharges, it's generally related to sediment erosion and transport within your watershed. In terms of sources, there are a few major contributors such as waste disposal and runoff from animals and humans, when it's applied as a concentrated fertilizer for crop growth, and when industrially used in detergents or for production of materials. As for nitrogen, besides its use in the explosion of airbag deployment, for example, nitrogen is most commonly found in gaseous form. Because of that, its cycling in the natural environment is more complicated than phosphorus, and therefore limiting nitrogen and having the same effect within the environment is more tricky. Particularly if you recall from the introduction module that some cyanos can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and bring it into the aquatic environment. Nonetheless, it too shares a number of sources similar to those of phosphorus. For this training and our guidance, we're not wading into the debate of whether reducing phosphorus or nitrogen is more important. Both are important for growth, so it greatly depends on the ecology of your water body, the relative contributions from sources within the watershed and the water body, and the timing of when these nutrients are available in molecular form for our cyanobacteria growth. So, with that said, it's critically important that you understand whether the dominant sources of the nutrients are arriving from outside of your lake, that is external loading from the watershed, or is it primarily originating from within the lake itself, which is termed internal loading? Depending on the depth of your water body, internal loading may occur through different mechanisms. Shallow water bodies may experience internal loading due to the resuspension of sediments from wave action, whereas in deeper waters, they may experience this loading through a chemical reaction when oxygen levels at the sediment surface become depleted, which results in phosphorus and nitrogen molecules being released. Then, depending on the mixing ability, such as turnover, frequency, and a stratified lake, the nutrients become available to primary producers like cyanobacteria. All right, so within this training module, we're focused on nutrient management strategies that originate from external loading. For ideas to tackle nutrients due to internal loading, please revisit the in-lake treatment training, which is module 4, and visit section 6 of the document that Liz just discussed. For practical purposes, it's critical to tackle your external sources of nutrients first, or the strategies applied to treat internal loading will likely be short-lived. All right, there are a number of steps and approaches and to cover this topic. The HCB team created this section and the web portal in particular to assemble relevant information that we found useful into one place. However, if you're following these basic steps, it'll help organize your approach implementing these strategies successfully. Some steps may require substantial resources, but even limited amounts of data and information may be very useful in identifying priorities. So these steps are to explore the issues with regulatory agencies, gather information, particularly about nutrient loading for the water body that you're concerned about, develop actions that secure community cooperation, determine critical areas for implementation of nutrient management strategies, implement those strategies using the most efficient and targeted approaches, and finally, evaluate the effectiveness, adapt, document, share lessons learned, and those success stories. So I'm going to step through these in a little bit more detail. So first one, explore the issue with regulatory agencies. Contact your local and state agencies to determine whether nutrients have been identified as an issue in your watershed and whether watershed plans or nutrient concentration goals, such as watershed-specific loads or site-specific criteria, have already been developed for the HCB-affected water body. You can find more information on this step in section 7.2. Next, gather information and data. It's critical to characterize the relative nutrient loads using models and monitoring as necessary. Identify the predominant nutrient sources in the watershed and prioritize nutrient sources for reduction. So leverage local knowledge, review permitting databases, et cetera, if no previous assessments exist. You can check out US EPA's How's My Waterway. It was designed to provide information collected from states, tribes, and local agencies related to the condition of water bodies throughout the U.S. Consider using nutrient source tracking to assist with characterizing primary nutrient sources, and visit the recovery potential screening tool that was designed for your state, which is found on EPA's website. More information regarding this step can be found in section 7.3, which provides specific examples and resources. Step 3, discover and reach out to affected stakeholders. Build outreach and education. This is a critical step. It's often overlooked because resource managers tend to focus on the technical issues. But stakeholders can assist by seeking information and filling data gaps identified in the previous steps. They can assist with seeking funding and funding strategies. Many of the success stories that we've discovered share the trait of funding through shared partnerships. They can also help by implementing the projects. When developing your outreach, consider the languages, culture, events, and demographics of the place and community. Also, consider conducting educational outreach at schools. For additional info on this subject, visit section 7.2. And in addition, for specific examples and resources for this objective, review the HCB web portal and HCB risk communication and section 5. All right, step 4, prioritize our actions. And this is the step where your efforts will really pay off. It's also the most difficult step because there are a multitude of potential actions that can lead to nutrient reduction in a myriad of scenarios. The ITRC team emphasized our efforts towards compiling these strategies into a single location with an easy-to-use graphic that categorizes strategies based on nutrient sources. Visit section 7.4 for more information, and later in the training, I'll cover a scenario on how to use the tools that we've created to assist you with these decisions. All right, step 5. Implement the strategies. And, you know, this is usually the fun, exciting, and fulfilling step. You get to spend all those funds that your team worked hard to secure. But just remember that for physical and structural strategies, ensure that you have secured the appropriate permits before you start your work. There are numerous case studies and examples found throughout Section 7 of the document that goes over strategy implementation. And the final step 6, to conduct effectiveness monitoring. As mentioned in module 4, before implementing all these steps, it's critical to devote time incorporating a monitoring plan that documents whether the actions that were taken were successful. This is particularly important when justifying the cost expended for the project to the funding entities, and it's also helpful for securing future funding as well. And it's also a useful way to identify lessons learned from unsuccessful projects. To put these steps into context, it's helpful to remember that excess nutrients can be regulated under the Clean Water Act. There are mechanisms to achieve reductions through these means. However, because nutrients can originate from both regulated, that is, point sources, and unregulated sources, non-point sources, most effective successes occur through a combination of both regulatory and incentive programs. When you get started, it's important to ask these questions. Have goals been established? Have total maximum daily loads, TMDLs, been established? Have load allocations been implemented into discharge permits? More information is found in section 7.2 on this topic. All right, so we've broken nutrient sources into point and non-point sources. Point sources are regulated. Non-point sources aren't regulated unless a TMDL has been approved. And we've categorized point sources into these three categories: municipal and industrial discharges, stormwater, and agriculture, specifically confined animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. As mentioned, non-point sources aren't regulated, but there are a number of established programs that incentivize nutrient reduction practices. So we categorize non-point sources into agriculture, stormwater, septic wastewater management, forest management, roadway management, and hydrologic and habitat modifications such as shoreline, riparian, and wetlands. To bridge these two categories, point sources and non-point sources, we also have a section on water quality trading. So water quality trading spans both those categories because it's typically deployed as a tool across nutrient source categories. Water quality trading is based on the premise that nutrient control from some sources may require costly measures, which while measures to reduce the same nutrient at other sources are less expensive. So for example, this may arise when treating nutrients at a point source becomes prohibitively more expensive than if those funds were deployed within the watershed at other sources that could reduce nutrients even more. So trading allows greater loss, or it allows us to provide less costly nutrient reductions from one source to be transferred to another source where reductions may be more expensive. This flexibility allows for better outcomes at lower costs. Water quality trading promotes nutrient reduction at lower costs while advancing improved environmental conditions. So visit section 7.7 to learn more about that. All right, now let's showcase some of the tools we've assembled. First, this is the strategy selection graphic. Each red dot corresponds to the point or non-point source categories that I just described earlier. Hovering over the dot pops up a window that provides a link to each of those strategies. The strategies include links to resources and examples of these strategies in use across the country. The strategies were broken into two themes, structural and non-structural. Structural strategies and nutrient management typically incorporate physical treatment, which can be either passive and natural or active and mechanical, such as sedimentation, filtration, adsorption, ion exchange, or disinfection. Non-structural strategies are generally programmatic in nature, such as education and outreach, regulation and enforcement, maintenance, or source control. In addition, we've compiled these strategies into an easy-to-read table, which is found in section 7.4. Each of these strategies are hyperlinked. That can take you right to the narrative that describes this, the strategies. All right, so let's go through a scenario. This scenario will mainly focus on the objectives of step four, which was to identify and prioritize your strategies. So this is Largeville Reservoir. You've seen it in a few of our earlier modules. It's got a rural water intake located here. See that? It's been receiving annual reports of taste and odor issues. And these reports tend to co-occur when cyanoblooms are located in the area. You can see that the lake is not only used for a drinking water source, but also has recreational opportunities around it. So let's zoom out a little bit and look at the watershed as a whole to kind of get a sense of where nutrient sources may be occurring within the watershed. So just to orient you, here's that rural water intake in the upper part of the reservoir. And we have a community called Farmtown that has some feedlots within the watershed. And also there's an area upstream that's called a Smallberg that has a lake. And then let's zoom in a bit on Smallberg and its area. So the lake here is a considerably enriched lake. It includes cabins with on-site wastewater or septic wastewater that may or may not be effectively implemented. Perhaps they were quickly assembled. And then you'll notice that, this water body, this pond is connected to the upstream part of Largeville Reservoir. So let's go over to our graphic. And just for example, I can hover over, a septic system, the red dot there at the septic system, or hover over the red dot that depicts a CAFO that pops up the hyperlinked strategy name, and we can click on that strategy. So for example, I click on the septic system. This gives you an example of the layout of the strategy. It goes into, like I mentioned, the, the structural and non-structural strategies for each of those strategies or potential source implementation sources. And also goes into the pros and cons of each of those BMPs. So finally, let me quickly touch upon a disclaimer from, implementing what we've even discussed today. So as you may or may not know, the climate is changing faster than our ability to reduce nutrients in our waterways. A rapidly changing climate may confound any attempts to prevent cyanoblooms, but controlling and reducing nutrient availability to these blooms is our best hope to reduce the extent, magnitude, or duration of these events. And Lake Erie provides a cautionary tale that managing nutrients is a constant issue. Nutrients were greatly reduced through point sources at the beginning of the Clean Water Act, but through time, non-point sources began to dominate the contributions to that system, and now they're exceeding those efforts. So we may not be successful to prevent these blooms, but reducing them through some aspect of HCBs can be considered a success. And then finally, there are many success stories, but as I mentioned, you need a long-term full-court press to reduce excess nutrients from prioritized at-risk water bodies is the critical takeaway in terms of nutrient management. Reducing nutrients in waterways takes tremendous fortitude and perseverance, and it's not a quick fix. It takes a long time and a lot of resources. It's also important to document and share your work because we couldn't put this web portal together without that kind of documentation that we've been able to uncover. So that's all I've got. And now I'm going to turn it over to Devin for questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Ben, for wrapping us up there. We will jump. Let me just look real quick if we have any questions here. We don't have any questions yet. So if anybody has anything that they would like the trainers to address, please put that in the chat now. And we will address that. I will just run through our post-class logistics here while we wait and see if we have any questions. So we would love to hear your feedback from today's training. So if you have a moment, we would really appreciate you filling out the feedback form that is available on the Clue In training page that brought you here today. That will be the way that you can get a certificate of completion if you're interested for the course by filling out the feedback form and checking the box to certify that you participated. I'd like to say a special thank you to our trainers for being here today and for contributing to the ITRC document and to our attendees as well. Ben, do you want me to read that one out loud?
Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, so we have a question here in the chat that I'll read for everybody. Besides, I'm going to assume that's nitrate and phosphorus monitoring. Are there other nutrients that you think would be interesting to monitor, such as iron? I believe Fe is iron.
Yes, chemistry. You got an A in chemistry, right? If you do have the resources to include iron in your analyses, that can be a really useful parameter to look at, particularly in sediments. So if you're trying to understand the ability of your in-lake sediments to sequester or hold on to phosphorus in the lake, that's a really good idea. It's probably a bit more difficult to interpret in like a river system. But certainly in lake, I think it would be it's a useful attribute to include. I hope that answers your question.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Looks like it did. So seeing as how that is our only question right now, I will just close up our training for today. And would like to just remind everybody that we do archive all of our online trainings, and they are available on the CLUIN website under archive trainings. And if you ever have any, you know, extra time or interested in additional training topics, I would encourage you to check that out, as we have lots of great archived classes on there. So with that, I will wish you all a wonderful rest of your afternoon, and we hope to see you in another online training event soon. Thank you all very much.